Snow White, we sing to thee in a far land beyond the sea. O stars that in the sunless year with shining hand by her were sown, in windy fields now bright and clear we see your silver blossom blown. O Elbereth Gilthoniel, we still remember, we who dwell in this far land beneath the trees, thy starlight on the western seas.
The song ended. These are high elves. They spoke the name of Elbereth, said Frodo in amazement. Few of that fairest folk are ever seen in the Shire. Not many now remain in Middle-earth, east of the great sea. This is indeed a strange chance. The hobbits sat in shadow by the wayside. Before long the elves came down the lane toward the valley. They passed slowly, and the hobbits could see the starlight glimmering on their hair and in their eyes. They bore no lights, yet as they walked a shimmer, like the light of the moon above the rim of the hills before it rises, seemed to fall about their feet. They were now silent, and as the last elf passed, he turned and looked towards the hobbits and laughed.
"Hail, Frodo!" he cried. "You're abroad late, or are you perhaps lost?"
Then he called aloud to the others, and all the company stopped and gathered round.
"This is indeed wonderful," they said. "Three hobbits in a wood at night? We have not seen such a thing since Bilbo went away. What is the meaning of it?"
"The meaning of it, fair people," said Frodo, "is simply that we seem to be going the same way as you are. I like walking under the stars, but I would welcome your company."
"But we have no need of other company, and hobbits are so dull," they laughed. "And how do you know that we go the same way as you? For you do not know whither we are going."
"And how do you know my name?" asked Frodo in return.
"We know many things," they said. "We have seen you often before with Bilbo, though you may not have seen us."
"Who are you, and who is your lord?" asked Frodo.
"I am Gildor," answered their leader, the elf who had first hailed him. "Gildor and Glorian of the House of Finrod. We are exiles, and most of our kindred have long ago departed, and we too are now only tarrying here a while, ere we return over the great sea. But some of our kinsfolk dwell still in peace in Rivendell. Come now, Frodo, tell us what you are doing, for we see that there is some shadow of fear upon you."
"Oh, wise people," interrupted Pippin eagerly, "tell us about the Black Riders."
"Black Riders?" they said in low voices.
"Why do you ask about Black Riders?" "Because two Black Riders have overtaken us today, or one has done so twice," said Pippin. "Only a little while ago he slipped away as you drew near."
The elves did not answer at once, but spoke together softly in their own tongue. At length Gildor turned to the hobbits. "We will not speak of this here," he said. "We think you had best come now with us. It is not our custom, but for this time we will take you on our road, and you shall lodge with us to-night, if you will."
"Oh, fair folk, this is good fortune beyond my hope," said Pippin.
Sam was speechless. "I thank you indeed, Gildor and Glorian," said Frodo, bowing. "Elen sila lumen omenti elvo. A star shines on the hour of our meeting," he added in the high elven speech.
"Be careful, friends," cried Gildor, laughing. "Speak no secrets. Here is a scholar in the ancient tongue. Bilbo was a good master. Hail, elf friend," he said, bowing to Frodo. "Come now with your friends and join our company. You had best walk in the middle, so that you may not stray. You may be weary before we halt."
"Why? Where are you going?" asked Frodo.
"For tonight we go to the woods on the hills above Woodhall. It is some miles, but you shall have rest at the end of it, and it will shorten your journey tomorrow."
They now marched on again in silence, and passed like shadows and faint lights. For elves,
even more than hobbits, could walk when they wished without sound or footfall. Pippin soon began to feel sleepy and staggered once or twice, but each time a tall elf at his side put out his arm and saved him from a fall. Sam walked along at Frodo's side, as if in a dream, with an expression on his face half of fear and half of astonished joy. The woods on either side became denser. The trees were now younger and thicker, and as the lane went lower, running down into a fold of the hills, there were many deep breaks of hazel on the rising slopes at either hand. At last the elves turned aside from the path. A green ride lay almost unseen through the thickets on the right, and this they followed as it wound away back up the wooded slopes onto the top of a shoulder of the hills that stood out into the lower land of the river valley. Suddenly they came out of the shadows of the trees, and before them lay a wide space of grass, grey under the night. On three sides the woods pressed upon it, but eastward the ground fell steeply, and the tops of the dark trees, growing at the bottom of the slope, were below their feet. Beyond, the low lands lay dim and flat under the stars. Nearer at hand a few lights twinkled in the village of Woodhall. The elves sat on the grass and spoke together in soft voices. They seemed to take no further notice of the hobbits. Frodo and his companions wrapped themselves in cloaks and blankets, and drowsiness stole over them. The night grew on, and the lights in the valley went out. Pippin fell asleep, pillowed on a green hillock. Away high in the east swung Remmereth, the netted stars, and slowly above the mists red Borgil rose, glowing like a jewel of fire. Then, by some shift of airs, all the mist was drawn away like a veil, and there leaned up, as he climbed over the rim of the world, the swordsman of the sky, Menelvagor, with his shining belt. The elves all burst into song. Suddenly, under the trees, a fire sprang up with a red light. "Come!" the elves called to the hobbits. "Come! Now is the time for speech and merriment!" Pippin sat up and rubbed his eyes. He shivered. "There is a fire in the hall, and food for hungry guests," said an elf standing before him. At the south end of the green sward there was an opening. There the green floor ran on into the wood, and formed a wide space like a hall, roofed by the boughs of trees. Their great trunks ran like pillars down each side. In the middle there was a wood fire blazing, and upon the tree pillars torches with lights of gold and silver were burning steadily. The elves sat round the fire upon the grass, or upon the sawn rings of old trunks. Some went to and fro bearing cups and pouring drink. Others brought food on heaped plates and dishes. "This is poor fare," they said to the hobbits, "for we are lodging in the greenwood far from our halls. If ever you are our guests at home, we will treat you better." "It seems to me good enough for a birthday party," said Frodo. Pippin afterwards recalled little of either food or drink, for his mind was filled with a light upon the elf faces, and the sound of voices so various and so beautiful that he felt in a waking dream. But he remembered that there was bread, surpassing the savour of a fair white loaf to one who is starving, and fruits sweet as wild berries and richer than the tended fruits of gardens. He drained a cup that was filled with a fragrant draught, cool as a clear fountain, golden as a summer afternoon. Sam could never describe in words, nor picture clearly to himself, what he felt or thought that night, though it remained in his memory as one of the chief events of his life. The nearest he ever got was to say, "Well, sir, if I could grow apples like that, I would call myself a gardener, but it was the singing that went to my heart, if you know what I mean." Frodo sat, eating, drinking, and talking with delight, but his mind was chiefly on the words spoken. He knew a little of the elf speech, and listened eagerly. Now and again he spoke to those that served him, and thanked them in their own language. They smiled at him, and said, laughing, "Here is a jewel among hobbits." After a while Pippin fell fast asleep, and was lifted up and borne away to a bower under the trees. There he was laid upon a soft bed, and slept the rest of the night away. Sam refused to leave his master. When Pippin had gone, he came and sat curled up at Frodo's feet, where at last he nodded and closed his eyes. Frodo remained long awake, talking with Gildor. They spoke of many things, old and new, and Frodo questioned Gildor about happenings in the wide world outside the Shire. The tidings were mostly sad and ominous, of gathering darkness, the wars of men, and the flight of the elves. At last Frodo asked the question that was nearest to his heart. "Tell me, Gildor, have you ever seen Bilbo since he left us?" Gildor smiled. "Yes," he answered, "twice. He said farewell to us on this very spot, but I saw him once again, far from here." He would say no more about Bilbo, and Frodo fell silent. "You do not ask me or tell me much that concerns yourself, Frodo," said Gildor, "but I already know a little, and I can read more in your face and in the thought behind your questions. You are leaving the Shire, and yet you doubt that you will find what you seek, or accomplish what you intend, or that you will ever return. Is not that so?" "It is," said Frodo, "but I thought my going was a secret known only to Gandalf and my faithful Sam." He looked down at Sam, who was snoring gently. "The secret will not reach the enemy from us," said Gildor. "The enemy?" said Frodo. "Then you know why I'm leaving the Shire?" "I do not know for what reason the enemy is pursuing you," answered Gildor. "But I perceive that he is, strange indeed, though that seems to me. And I warn you that peril is now both before you and behind you, and upon either side."
"You mean the riders? I fear that they were servants of the enemy. What are the Black Riders?"
"Has Gandalf told you nothing?"
"Nothing about such creatures."
"Then I think it is not for me to say more, lest terror should keep you from your journey, for it seems to me that you have set out only just in time, if indeed you are in time. You must now make haste, and neither stay nor turn back, for the Shire is no longer any protection to you."
"I can't imagine what information could be more terrifying than your hints and warnings," exclaimed Frodo. "I knew that danger lay ahead, of course, but I didn't expect to meet it in our own Shire. Can't a hobbit walk from the water to the river in peace?"
"But it is not your own Shire," said Gildor. "Others dwelt here before hobbits were, and others will dwell here again when hobbits are no more. The wide world is all about you. You can fence yourselves in, but you cannot for ever fence it out."
"I know. And yet it's always seemed so safe and familiar. What can I do now? My plan was to leave the Shire secretly and make my way to Rivendell, but now my footsteps are dogged before ever I get to Buckland."
"I think you should still follow that plan," said Gildor. "I do not think the road will prove too hard for your courage, but if you desire clearer counsel, you should ask Gandalf. I do not know the reason for your flight, and therefore I do not know by what means your pursuers will assail you. These things Gandalf must know. I suppose that you will see him before you leave the Shire?"
"I hope so. But that's another thing that makes me anxious. I have been expecting Gandalf for many days. He was to have come to Hobbiton at the latest 2 nights ago. But he's never appeared. Now I'm wondering what can have happened. Should I wait for him?"
Gildor was silent for a moment. "I do not like this news," he said at last. "That Gandalf should be late does not bode well. But it is said, 'Do not meddle in the affairs of wizards, for they are subtle and quick to anger.' The choice is yours, to go or wait."
"And it is also said," answered Frodo, "go not to the elves for counsel, for they will say both no and yes."
"Is it indeed?" laughed Gildor. "Elves seldom give unguarded advice, for advice is a dangerous gift, even from the wise to the wise, and all courses may run ill. But what would you? You have not told me all concerning yourself, and how then shall I choose better than you? But if you demand advice, I will for friendship's sake give it. I think you should now go at once, without delay, and if Gandalf does not come before you set out, then I also advise this, Do not go alone. Take such friends as are trusty and willing. Now you should be grateful, for I do not give this counsel gladly. The elves have their own labours and their own sorrows, and they are little concerned with the ways of hobbits, or of any other creatures upon earth. Our paths cross theirs seldom, by chance or purpose. In this meeting there may be more than chance. But the purpose is not clear to me, and I fear to say too much. I'm deeply grateful, said Frodo. But I wish you'd tell me plainly what the Black Riders are. If I take your advice, I may not see Gandalf for a long time, and I ought to know what's the danger that pursues me. Is it not enough to know that they are servants of the enemy? Answered Gildor. Flee them. Speak no words to them. They are deadly. Ask no more of me. But my heart forebodes that, ere all is ended, you, Frodo, son of Drogo, will know more of these fell things than Gildor and Glorion. May Elbereth protect you. But where shall I find courage? Asked Frodo. That is what I chiefly need. Courage is found in unlikely places, said Gildor. Be of good hope. Sleep now. In the morning we shall have gone, but we will send our messages through the lands. The wandering companies shall know of your journey, and those that have power for good shall be on the watch. I name you Elf Friend, and may the stars shine upon the end of your road. Seldom have we had such delight in strangers, and it is fair to hear words of the ancient speech from the lips of other wanderers in the world. Frodo felt sleep coming upon him, even as Gildor finished speaking. I'll sleep now, he said, and the elf led him to a bower beside Pippin, and he threw himself upon a bed and fell at once into a dreamless slumber. Chapter 4 A Shortcut to Mushrooms. In the morning Frodo woke refreshed. He was lying in a bower made by a living tree with branches laced and drooping to the ground. His bed was of fern and grass, deep and soft and strangely fragrant. The sun was shining through the fluttering leaves, which were still green upon the tree. He jumped up and went out. Sam was sitting on the grass near the edge of the wood. Pippin was standing studying the sky and weather. There was no sign of the elves.
"They have left us fruit and drink and bread," said Pippin. "Come and have your breakfast. The bread tastes almost as good as it did last night. I didn't want to leave you any, but Sam insisted."
Frodo sat down beside Sam and began to eat.
"What is the plan for today?" asked Pippin.
"To walk to Buckleby as quickly as possible," answered Frodo, and gave his attention to the food.
"Do you think we shall see anything of those riders?" asked Pippin cheerfully.
Under the morning sun the prospect of seeing a whole troop of them didn't seem very alarming to him. "Yes, probably," said Frodo, not liking the reminder, "but I hope to get across the river without their seeing us."
"Did you find out anything about them from Gildor?"
"Not much, only hints and riddles," said Frodo evasively.
"Did you ask about the sniffing?"
"We didn't discuss it," said Frodo with his mouth full.
"You should have. I'm sure it's very important."
"In that case, I'm sure Gildor would have refused to explain it," said Frodo sharply. "And now leave me in peace for a bit. I don't want to answer a string of questions while I'm eating. I want to think."
"Good heavens," said Pippin. "At breakfast?"
He walked away towards the edge of the green. From Frodo's mind the bright morning, treacherously bright, he thought, had not banished the fear of pursuit, and he pondered the words of Gildor. The merry voice of Pippin came to him. He was running on the green turf and singing.
"No, I could not," he said to himself. "It is one thing to take my young friends walking over the Shire with me until we are hungry and weary and food and bed are sweet. To take them into exile, where hunger and weariness may have no cure, is quite another, even if they are willing to come. The inheritance is mine alone. I don't think I ought even to take Sam." He looked at Sam Gamgee, and discovered that Sam was watching him.
"Well, Sam," he said, "what about it?"
I'm leaving the Shire as soon as ever I can. In fact, I've made up my mind now not even to wait a day at Crickhollow, if it can be helped.
Very good, sir.
You still mean to come with me?
I do.
It's going to be very dangerous, Sam. It's already dangerous. Most likely neither of us will come back.
If you don't come back, sir, then I shan't, that's certain, said Sam. Don't you leave him, they said to me. Leave him, I said. I never mean to. I'm going to stay with him if he climbs to the moon, and if any of those Black Riders try to stop him, they'll have Sam Gamgee to reckon with, I said. They laughed.
Who are they? And what are you talking about?
The elves, sir. We had some talk last night, and they seemed to know you were going away, so I didn't see the use of denying it.
Wonderful folk, elves, sir, wonderful.
They are, said Frodo. Do you like them still, now you have had a closer view?
They seem a bit above my likes and dislikes, so to speak, answered Sam slowly. It don't seem to matter what I think about them. They are quite different from what I expected, so old and young and so gay and sad, as it were.
Frodo looked at Sam, rather startled, half expecting to see some outward sign of the odd change that seemed to have come over him. It didn't sound like the voice of the old Sam Gamgee that he thought he knew, but it looked like the old Sam Gamgee sitting there, except that his face was unusually thoughtful.
"Do you feel any need to leave the Shire now? Now that your wish to see them has come true already?" he asked.
"Yes, sir.
I don't know how to say it, but after last night I feel different. I seem to see ahead in a kind of way. I know we're going to take a very long road into darkness, but I know I can't turn back. It isn't to see elves now, nor dragons, nor mountains that I want. I don't rightly know what I want. But I have something to do before the end, and it lies ahead, not in the Shire. I must see it through, sir, if you understand me.
I don't altogether, but I understand that Gandalf chose me a good companion. I'm content. We'll go together. Frodo finished his breakfast in silence. Then, standing up, he looked over the land ahead and called to Pippin.
All ready to start? He said as Pippin ran up. "We must be getting off at once. We slept late, and there are a good many miles to go."
"You slept late, you mean?" said Pippin. "I was up long before, and we're only waiting for you to finish eating and thinking."
"I've finished both now, and I'm going to make for Bucklebury Ferry as quickly as possible. I'm not going out of the way, back to the road we left last night. I'm going to cut straight across country from here."
"Then you are going to fly," said Pippin. "You won't cut straight on foot anywhere in this country."
"We can cut straighter than the road anyway," answered Frodo. "The ferry is east from Woodhall, but the hard road curves away to the left. You can see a bend of it away north over there. It goes round the north end of the Marish so as to strike the causeway from the bridge above Stock. But that is miles out of the way. We could save a quarter of the distance if we made a line for the ferry from where we stand."
"Short cuts make long delays,"
argued Pippin.
"The country's rough round here, and there are bogs and all kinds of difficulties down in the Marish. I know the land in these parts, and if you are worrying about Black Riders, I can't see that it's any worse meeting them on a road than in a wood or a field."
"It's less easy to find people in the woods and fields," answered Frodo. "And if you are supposed to be on the road, there's some chance that you will be looked for on the road and not off it."
"All right," said Pippin. "I'll follow you into every bog and ditch, but it's hard. I'd counted on passing the Golden Perch at Stock before sundown. The best beer in the East Farthing, or used to be. It's a long time since I tasted it."
"That settles it," said Frodo. "Short cuts make delays, but inns make longer ones. At all costs we must keep you away from the Golden Perch. We want to get to Bucklebury before dark. What do you say, Sam?"
"I'll go along with you, Mr. Frodo," said Sam, in spite of private misgiving and a deep regret for the best beer in the East Farthing.
"Then if we're going to toil through bog and briar, let's go now," said Pippin.
It was already nearly as hot as it had been the day before, but clouds were beginning to come up from the west.
It looked likely to turn to rain. The hobbits scrambled down a steep green bank and plunged into the thick trees below. Their course had been chosen to leave Woodhall to their left, and to cut slanting through the woods that clustered along the eastern side of the hill until they reached the flats beyond. Then they could make straight for the ferry over country that was open, except for a few ditches and fences. Frodo reckoned they had 18 miles to go in a straight line. He soon found that the thicket was closer and more tangled than it had appeared. There were no paths in the undergrowth, and they didn't get on very fast. When they had struggled to the bottom of the bank, they found a stream running down from the hills behind in a deeply dug bed with steep, slippery sides overhung with brambles. Most inconveniently, it cut across the line they had chosen. They couldn't jump over it, nor indeed get across it at all, without getting wet, scratched, and muddy. They halted, wondering what to do.
"First check," said Pippin, smiling grimly.
Sam Gamgee looked back. Through an opening in the trees he caught a glimpse of the top of the green bank from which they had climbed down.
"Look,"
he said, clutching Frodo by the arm. They all looked, and on the edge, high above them, they saw against the sky a horse standing. Beside it stooped a black figure. They at once gave up any idea of going back. Frodo led the way and plunged quickly into the thick bushes beside the stream. "Whew," he said to Pippin, "we were both right. The short cut has gone crooked already, but we got under cover only just in time. You've got sharp ears, Sam. Can you hear anything coming?" They stood still, almost holding their breath as they listened, but there was no sound of pursuit.
"I don't fancy he would try bringing his horse down that bank," said Sam, "but I guess he knows we came down it. We'd better be going on."
Going on was not altogether easy. They had packs to carry, and the bushes and brambles were reluctant to let them through. They were cut off from the wind by the ridge behind, and the air was still and stuffy. When they forced their way at last into more open ground, they were hot and tired and very scratched, and they were also no longer certain of the direction in which they were going. The banks of the stream sank as it reached the levels and became broader and shallower, wandering off towards the marish and the river.
"Why, this is the Stockbrook," said Pippin. "If we are going to try and get back onto our course, we must cross at once and bear right."
They waded the stream and hurried over a wide open space, rush-grown and treeless, on the further side. Beyond that they came again to a belt of trees, tall oaks for the most part, with here and there an elm tree or an ash. The ground was fairly level, and there was little undergrowth, but the trees were too close for them to see far ahead. The leaves blew upwards in sudden gusts of wind, and spots of rain began to fall from the overcast sky. Then the wind died away, and the rain came streaming down. They trudged along as fast as they could, over patches of grass and through thick drifts of old leaves, and all about them the rain pattered and trickled. They didn't talk, but kept glancing back and from side to side. After half an hour, Pippin said,
"I hope we haven't turned too much toward the south and are not walking longwise through this wood. It's not a very broad belt. I should have said no more than a mile at the widest, and we ought to have been through it by now."
"It's no good our starting to go in zigzags," said Frodo. "That won't mend matters. Let's keep on as we're going. I'm not sure that I want to come out into the open yet." They went on for perhaps another couple of miles. Then the sun gleamed out of ragged clouds again, and the rain lessened. It was now past midday, and they felt it was high time for lunch. They halted under an elm tree. Its leaves, though fast turning yellow, were still thick, and the ground at its feet was fairly dry and sheltered. When they came to make their meal, they found that the elves had filled their bottles with a clear drink, pale golden in colour. It had the scent of a honey made of many flowers, and was wonderfully refreshing. Very soon they were laughing and snapping their fingers at rain and at black riders. The last few miles, they felt, would soon be behind them. Frodo propped his back against the tree trunk and closed his eyes.
Sam and Pippin sat near, and they began to hum, and then to sing softly.
Ho, 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 to the bottle I go, to heal my heart and drown my woe. Rain may fall and wind may blow, and many miles be still to go. But under a tall tree I will lie, and let the clouds go sailing by.
Ho, 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 they began again louder. They stopped short suddenly. Frodo sprang to his feet. A long-drawn wail came down the wind, like the cry of some evil and lonely creature. It rose and fell and ended on a high, piercing note. Even as they sat and stood, as if suddenly frozen, it was answered by another cry, fainter and further off, but no less chilling to the blood. There was then a silence, broken only by the sound of the wind in the leaves. Pippin asked at last, trying to speak lightly, but quavering a little.
"If it was a bird, it was one that I've never heard in the Shire before."
"It was not bird or beast," said Frodo. "It was a call or a signal. There were words in that cry, though I could not catch them. But no hobbit has such a voice." No more was said about it. They were all thinking of the riders, but no one spoke of them. They were now reluctant either to stay or go on, but sooner or later they had got to get across the open country to the ferry, and it was best to go sooner and in daylight. In a few moments they had shouldered their packs again and were off. Before long the wood came to a sudden end. Wide grassland stretched before them. They now saw that they had, in fact, turned too much to the south. Away over the flats they could glimpse the low hill of Bucklebury across the river, but it was now to their left. Creeping cautiously out from the edge of the trees, they set off across the open as quickly as they could. At first they felt afraid, away from the shelter of the wood. Far back behind them stood the high place where they had breakfasted. Frodo half expected to see the small distant figure of a horseman on the ridge dark against the sky, but there was no sign of one. The sun escaping from the breaking clouds as it sank towards the hills they had left was now shining brightly again. Their fear left them, though they still felt uneasy. But the land became steadily more tame and well ordered. Soon they came into well-tended fields and meadows. There were hedges and gates and dikes for drainage. Everything seemed quiet and peaceful, just an ordinary corner of the Shire. Their spirits rose with every step. The line of the river grew nearer, and the black riders began to seem like phantoms of the woods now left far behind. They passed along the edge of a huge turnip field and came to a stout gate. Beyond it a rutted lane ran between low, well-laid hedges towards a distant clump of trees. Pippin stopped.
"I know these fields and this gate," he said. "This is Bamfurlong, old Farmer Maggot's land. That's his farm, away there in the trees."
"One trouble after another," said Frodo, looking nearly as much alarmed as if Pippin had declared the lane was the slot leading to a dragon's den. The others looked at him in surprise.
"What's wrong with old Maggot?" asked Pippin. "He's a good friend to all the Brandybucks. Of course he's a terror to trespassers, and keeps ferocious dogs, but after all, folk down here and near the border and have to be more on their guard."
"I know," said Frodo, "but all the same," he added with a shamefaced laugh, "I'm terrified of him and his dogs. I've avoided his farm for years and years. He caught me several times trespassing after mushrooms when I was a youngster at Brandy Hall. On the last occasion he beat me, and then took me and showed me to his dogs. 'See, lads,' he said, 'next time this young varmint sets foot on my land, you can eat him. Now see him off.' They chased me all the way to the ferry. I've never got over the fright, though I dare say the beasts knew their business and wouldn't really have touched me." Pippin laughed.
"Well, it's time you made it up, especially if you're coming back to live in Buckland. Old Maggot is really a stout fellow, if you leave his mushrooms alone. Let's get into the lane, and then we shan't be trespassing. If we meet him, I'll do the talking. He's a friend of Merry's, and I used to come here with him a good deal at one time."
They went along the lane until they saw the thatched roofs of a large house and farm buildings peeping out among the trees ahead. The maggots and the puddyfoots of stock and most of the inhabitants of the marish were house-dwellers, and his farm was stoutly built of brick and had a high wall all around it. There was a wide wooden gate opening out of the wall into the lane. Suddenly, as they drew nearer, a terrific baying and barking broke out, and a loud voice was heard shouting, "Grip! Fang! Wolf! Come on, lads!" Frodo and Sam stopped dead, but Pippin walked on a few paces. The gate opened, and three huge dogs came pelting out into the lane and dashed towards the travellers, barking fiercely. They took no notice of Pippin, but Sam shrank against the wall, while two wolvish-looking dogs sniffed at him suspiciously and snarled if he moved. The largest and most ferocious of the three halted in front of Frodo, bristling and growling. Through the gate there now appeared a broad, thick-set hobbit with a round red face.
"Hallo, hallo, and who may you be, and what may you be wanting?" he asked.
"Good afternoon, Mr. Maggot," said Pippin.
The farmer looked at him closely.
"Well, if it isn't Master Pippin, Mr. Peregrine Took, I should say," he cried, changing from a scowl to a grin. "It's a long time since I saw you round here. It's lucky for you that I know you. I was just going out to set my dogs on any strangers. There are some funny things going on today. Of course, we do get queer folk wandering in these parts at times, too near the river," he said, shaking his head. "But this fellow was the most outlandish I've ever set eyes on. He won't cross my land without leave a second time, not if I can stop him."
"What fellow do you mean?" asked Pippin.
"Then you haven't seen him," said the farmer. "He went up the lane toward the causeway not a long while back. He was a funny customer and asking funny questions. But perhaps you'll come along inside and we'll pass the news more comfortable. I've a drop of good ale on tap, if you and your friends are willing, Mr. Took."
It seemed plain that the farmer would tell them more if allowed to do it in his own time and fashion, so they all accepted the invitation.
"What about the dogs?" asked Frodo anxiously.
The farmer laughed.
"They won't harm you, not unless I tell them to. Here, Grip! Fang! Heel!" he cried. "Heel, Wolf!"
To the relief of Frodo and Sam, the dogs walked away and let them go free. Pippin introduced the other two to the farmer.
"Mr. Frodo Baggins," he said. "You may not remember him, but he used to live at Brandy Hall."
At the name Baggins the farmer started and gave Frodo a sharp glance. For a moment Frodo thought that the memory of stolen mushrooms had been aroused and that the dogs would be told to see him off. But Farmer Maggot took him by the arm.
"Well, if that isn't queerer than ever," he exclaimed. "Mr. Baggins, is it? Come inside. We must have a talk."
They went into the farmer's kitchen and sat by the wide fireplace. Mrs. Maggot brought out beer in a huge jug and filled four large mugs. It was a good brew, and Pippin found himself more than compensated for missing the golden perch. Sam sipped his beer suspiciously. He had a natural mistrust of the inhabitants of other parts of the shire, and also he was not disposed to be quick friends with anyone who had beaten his master, however long ago. After a few remarks about the weather and the agricultural prospects, which were no worse than usual, Farmer Maggot put down his mug and looked at them all in turn.
"Now, Mr. Peregrine," he said, "where might you be coming from, and where might you be going to? Were you coming to visit me? For if so, you'd gone past my gate without my seeing you."
"Well, no," answered Pippin. "To tell you the truth, since you've guessed it, we got into the lane from the other end. We'd come over your fields, but that was quite by accident. We lost our way in the woods, back near Woodhall, trying to take a short cut to the ferry."
"If you were in a hurry, the road would have served you better," said the farmer. "But I wasn't worrying about that. You have leave to walk over my land, if you have a mind, Mr. Peregrine. And you, Mr. Baggins,
though I dare say you still like mushrooms." He laughed. "Ah, yes, I recognise the name. I recollect the time when young Frodo Baggins was one of the worst young rascals of Buckland. But it wasn't mushrooms I was thinking of. I had just heard the name Baggins before you turned up. What do you think that funny customer asked me?" They waited anxiously for him to go on. "Well," the farmer continued, approaching his point with slow relish, "he came riding on a big black horse in at the gate, which happened to be open, and right up to my door. All black he was himself, too, and cloaked and hooded up, as if he didn't want to be known. Now, what in the shire can he want?" I thought to myself. "We don't see many of the big folk over the border, and anyway, I'd never heard of any like this black fellow. "Good day to you," I says, going out to him. "This lane don't lead anywhere, and wherever you may be going, your quickest way will be back to the road." I didn't like the looks of him, and when Grip came out, he took one sniff and let out a yelp as if he'd been stung. He put down his tail and bolted off howling. The black fellow sat quite still. "I come from yonder," he said, slow and stiff-like, pointing back west over my fields, if you please. "Have you seen Baggins?" he asked in a queer voice, and bent low towards me. I couldn't see any face, for his hood fell down so low, and I felt a sort of shiver down my back. But I didn't see why he should come riding over my land so bold. "Be off," I said. "There are no Bagginses here. You're in the wrong part of the shire. You'd better go back west to Hobbiton, but you can go by road this time." "Baggins has left," he answered in a whisper. "He's coming. He's not far away. I wish to find him. If he passes, will you tell me? I will come back with gold." "No, you won't," I said. "You'll go back where you belong, double quick. I give you 1 minute before I call all my dogs." He gave a sort of hiss. It might have been laughing, and it might not. Then he spurred his great horse right at me, and I jumped out of the way only just in time. I called the dogs, but he swung off and rode through the gate and up the lane toward the causeway like a bolt of thunder. What do you think of that?" Frodo sat for a moment looking at the fire, but his only thought was how on earth would they reach the ferry. "I don't know what to think," he said at last. "Then I'll tell you what to think," said Maggot. "You should never have gone mixing up yourself with Hobbiton folk, Mr. Frodo. Folk are queer up there." Sam stirred in his chair and looked at the farmer with an unfriendly eye. "But you were always a reckless lad. When I heard you had left the brandy bucks and gone off to that old Mr. Bilbo, I said that you were going to find trouble. Mark my words, this all comes of those strange doings of Mr. Bilbo's. His money was got in some strange fashion in foreign parts, they say. Maybe there's some that want to know what has become of the gold and jewels that he buried in the hill of Hobbiton, as I hear." Frodo said nothing. The shrewd guesses of the farmer were rather disconcerting. "Well, Mr. Frodo," Maggot went on, "I'm glad that you've had the sense to come back to Buckland. My advice is stay here, and don't get mixed up with those outlandish folk. You'll have friends in these parts. If any of these black fellows come after you again, I'll deal with them. I'll say you're dead, or have left the shire, or anything you like. And that might be true enough, for as like as not, it's old Mr. Bilbo they want news of." "Maybe you're right," said Frodo, avoiding the farmer's eye and staring at the fire. Maggot looked at him thoughtfully. "Well, I see you have ideas of your own," he said. "It's as plain as my nose that no accident brought you and that rider here on the same afternoon, and maybe my news was no great news to you after all. I'm not asking you to tell me anything you have a mind to keep to yourself, but I see you're in some kind of trouble. Perhaps you're thinking it won't be too easy to get to the ferry without being caught."
"I was thinking so," said Frodo. "But we've got to try and get there. and it won't be done by sitting and thinking. So I'm afraid we must be going. Thank you very much indeed for your kindness. I've been in terror of you and your dogs for over 30 years, Farmer Maggot, though you may laugh to hear it. It's a pity, for I've missed a good friend, and now I'm sorry to leave so soon. But I'll come back, perhaps, one day, if I get a chance.
You'll be welcome when you come, said Maggot. But now I've a notion. It's near sundown already, and we're going to have our supper, for we mostly go to bed soon after the sun. If you and Mr. Peregrine and all could stay and have a bite with us, we would be pleased.
And so should we, said Frodo. But we must be going at once, I'm afraid. Even now it will be dark before we can reach the ferry.
Ah, but wait a minute. I was going to say, after a bit of supper, I'll get out a small wagon and I'll drive you all to the ferry. That will save you a good step, and it might also save you trouble of another sort.
Frodo now accepted the invitation gratefully, to the relief of Pippin and Sam. The sun was already behind the western hills, and the light was failing. Two of Maggot's sons and his three daughters came in, and a generous supper was laid on the large table. The kitchen was lit with candles, and the fire was mended. Mrs. Maggot bustled in and out. One or two other hobbits belonging to the farm household came in. In a short while, 14 sat down to eat. There was beer in plenty, and a mighty dish of mushrooms and bacon, besides much other solid farmhouse fare. The dogs lay by the fire and gnawed rinds and cracked bones. When they'd finished, the farmer and his sons went out with a lantern and got the wagon ready. It was dark in the yard when the guests came out. They threw their packs on board and climbed in. The farmer sat in the driving seat and whipped up his two stout ponies. His wife stood in the light of the open door.
"You be careful of yourself, Maggot," she called. "Don't go arguing with any foreigners, and come straight back."
"I will," said he, and drove out of the gate. There was now no breath of wind stirring. The night was still and quiet, and a chill was in the air. They went without lights and took it slowly. After a mile or two the lane came to an end, crossing a deep dike and climbing a short slope up onto the high-banked causeway. Maggot got down and took a good look either way, north and south, but nothing could be seen in the darkness, and there was not a sound in the still air. Thin strands of river mist were hanging above the dikes and crawling over the fields.
"It's going to be thick," said Maggot, "but I'll not light my lanterns till I turn for home. We'll hear anything on the road long before we meet it tonight."
It was 5 miles or more from Maggot's Lane to the ferry. The hobbits wrapped themselves up, but their ears were strained for any sound above the creak of the wheels and the slow clop of the ponies' hoofs. The wagon seemed slower than a snail to Frodo. Beside him Pippin was nodding toward sleep, but Sam was staring forwards into the rising fog. They reached the entrance to the ferry lane at last. It was marked by 2 tall white posts that suddenly loomed up on their right. Farmer Maggot drew in his ponies, and the wagon creaked to a halt. They were just beginning to scramble out when suddenly they heard what they had all been dreading, hoofs on the road ahead. The sound was coming towards them. Maggot jumped down and stood holding the ponies' heads and peering forward into the gloom. Clip-clop, clip-clop, came the approaching rider. The fall of the hooves sounded loud in the still, foggy air.
"You'd better be hidden, Mr. Frodo," said Sam anxiously. "You get down in the wagon and cover up with blankets, and we'll send this rider to the rightabouts."
He climbed out and went to the farmer's side. Black riders would have to ride over him to get near the wagon.
Clip-clop, clip-clop,
the rider was nearly on them.
"Hello there!" cried Farmer Maggot.
The advancing hooves stopped short. They thought they could dimly guess a dark, cloaked shape in the mist, a yard or two ahead.
"Now then," said the farmer, throwing the reins to Sam and striding forward. "Don't you come a step nearer. What do you want, and where are you going?"
"I want Mr. Baggins. Have you seen him?"
said a muffled voice. But the voice was the voice of Merry Brandybuck. A dark lantern was uncovered, and its light fell on the astonished face of the farmer.
"Mr. Merry!" he cried.
"Yes, of course. Who did you think it was?" said Merry, coming forward. As he came out of the mist and their fears subsided, he seemed suddenly to diminish to ordinary hobbit size. He was riding a pony, and a scarf was swathed round his neck and over his chin to keep out the fog. Frodo sprang out of the wagon to greet him.
"So there you are at last," said Merry. "I was beginning to wonder if you'd turn up at all today, and I was just going back to supper. When it grew foggy, I came across and rode up towards Stock to see if you'd fallen in any ditches. But I'm blessed if I know which way you've come. Where did you find them, Mr. Maggot? In your duck pond?" "No, I caught them trespassing," said the farmer, "and nearly set my dogs on them. But they'll tell you all the story, I've no doubt. Now, if you'll excuse me, Mr. Merry and Mr. Frodo and all, I'd best be turning for home. Mrs. Maggot will be worriting with the night getting thick." He backed the wagon into the lane and turned it. "Well, good night to you all," he said. "It's been a queer day, and no mistake. But all's well as ends well, though perhaps we should not say that until we reach our own doors. I'll not deny that I'll be glad now when I do." He lit his lanterns and got up. Suddenly he produced a large basket from under the seat. "I was nearly forgetting," he said. "Mrs. Maggot put this up for Mr. Baggins with her compliments." He handed it down and moved off, followed by a chorus of thanks and good nights. They watched the pale rings of light round his lanterns as they dwindled into the foggy night. Suddenly Frodo laughed. From the covered basket he held, the scent of mushrooms was rising. Chapter 5. A Conspiracy Unmasked. "Now we'd better get home ourselves," said Merry. "There's something funny about all this, I see, but it must wait till we get in." They turned down the ferry lane, which was straight and well kept, and edged with large whitewashed stones. In 100 yards or so it brought them to the river bank, where there was a broad wooden landing stage. A large flat ferry boat was moored beside it. The white bollards near the water's edge glimmered in the light of 2 lamps on high posts. Behind them the mists in the flat fields were now above the hedges, but the water before them was dark, with only a few curling wisps like steam among the reeds by the bank. There seemed to be less fog on the further side. Merry led the pony over a gangway onto the ferry, and the others followed. Merry then pushed slowly off with a long pole. The brandy wine flowed slow and broad before them. On the other side the bank was steep, and up it a winding path climbed from the further landing. Lamps were twinkling there. Behind loomed up the Buck Hill, and out of it, through stray shrouds of mist, shone many round windows, yellow and red. They were the windows of Brandy Hall, the ancient home of the Brandybucks. Long ago, Gordondad Oldbuck, head of the Oldbuck family, one of the oldest in the Marish, or indeed in the Shire, had crossed the river, which was the original boundary of the land eastwards. He built and excavated Brandy Hall, changed his name to Brandybuck, and settled down to become master of what was virtually a small, independent country. His family grew and grew, and after his days continued to grow, until Brandy Hall occupied the whole of the low hill, and had 3 large front doors, many side doors, and about 100 windows. The Brandybucks and their numerous dependents then began to borrow, and later to build, all round about. That was the origin of Buckland, a thickly inhabited strip between the river and the Old Forest, a sort of colony from the Shire. Its chief village was Bucklebury, clustering in the banks and slopes behind Brandy Hall. The people in the Marish were friendly with the Bucklanders, and the authority of the Master of the Hall, as the head of the Brandybuck family was called, was still acknowledged by the farmers between Stock and Rushy.
but most of the folk of the old shire regarded the Bucklanders as peculiar, half-foreigners, as it were. Though, as a matter of fact, they were not very different from the other hobbits of the Four Farthings, except in one point. They were fond of boats, and some of them could swim. Their land was originally unprotected from the east, but on that side they had built a hedge, the High Hay. It had been planted many generations ago, and was now thick and tall, for it was constantly tended. It ran all the way from Brandywine Bridge, in a big loop curving away from the river, to Hay's End, where the Withy Windle flowed out of the forest into the Brandywine, well over 20 miles from end to end. But, of course, it was not a complete protection. The forest drew close to the hedge in many places. The Bucklanders kept their doors locked after dark, and that also was not usual in the shire. The ferry boat moved slowly across the water. The Buckland shore drew nearer. Sam was the only member of the party who had not been over the river before. He had a strange feeling as the slow, gurgling stream slipped by. His old life lay behind in the mists. Dark adventure lay in front. He scratched his head, and for a moment had a passing wish that Mr. Frodo could have gone on living quietly at Bag End. The four hobbits stepped off the ferry. Merry was tying it up, and Pippin was already leading the pony up the path, when Sam, who had been looking back, as if to take farewell of the shire, said in a hoarse whisper,
"Look back, Mr. Frodo. Do you see anything?"
On the far stage, under the distant lamps, they could just make out a figure. It looked like a dark black bundle left behind. But as they looked, it seemed to move and sway this way and that, as if searching the ground. It then crawled, or went crouching, back into the gloom beyond the lamps.
"What in the shire is that?" exclaimed Merry.
"Something that is following us," said Frodo. "But don't ask any more now. Let's get away at once." They hurried up the path to the top of the bank, but when they looked back the far shore was shrouded in mist, and nothing could be seen. "Thank goodness you don't keep any boats on the west bank," said Frodo. "Can horses cross the river?" "They can go 20 miles north to Brandywine Bridge. Or they might swim," answered Merry, "though I never heard of any horse swimming the Brandywine. But what have horses to do with it?" "I'll tell you later. Let's get indoors, and then we can talk." "All right. You and Pippin know your way, so I'll just ride on and tell Fatty Bulger that you're coming. We'll see about supper and things." "We had our supper early with Farmer Maggot," said Frodo, "but we could do with another."
"You shall have it.
Give me that basket," said Merry, and rode ahead into the darkness. It was some distance from the Brandywine to Frodo's new house at Crick Hollow. They passed Buck Hill and Brandy Hall on their left, and on the outskirts of Bucklebury struck the main road of Buckland that ran south from the bridge. Half a mile northward along this, they came to a lane opening on their right. This they followed for a couple of miles as it climbed up and down into the country. At last they came to a narrow gate in a thick hedge. Nothing could be seen of the house in the dark. It stood back from the lane in the middle of a wide circle of lawn, surrounded by a belt of low trees inside the outer hedge. Frodo had chosen it because it stood in an out-of-the-way corner of the country, and there were no other dwellings close by. You could get in and out without being noticed. It had been built a long while before by the Brandybucks for the use of guests, or members of the family that wished to escape from the crowded life of Brandy Hall for a time. It was an old-fashioned, countrified house, as much like a hobbit hole as possible. It was long and low, with no upper story, and it had a roof of turf, round windows, and a large round door. As they walked up the green path from the gate, no light was visible. The windows were dark and shuttered. Frodo knocked on the door, and Fatty Bulger opened it. A friendly light streamed out. They slipped in quickly and shut themselves and the light inside. They were in a wide hall with doors on either side,
In front of them a passage ran back down the middle of the house. "Well, what do you think of it?" asked Mary, coming up the passage.